The Hard Shoulder with Ciara Kelly and Shane Coleman on News Talk
with Kia.
Winners and sinners on The Hard Shoulder.
Okay, this is Winners and Sinners when we look back at the week that was with a few twists. We're joined by Today FM's Alison Curtis and Off the Ball's Cameron Hill. Cameron, might start with you first. Who is your winner, or what is your winner of the week?
My winner is rewatching old stuff. So at the moment, I am back on the West Wing hype at the moment. I think up to season 3 as of last night, and just said I'd try to rewatch it mainly because it's great. Fallen asleep fair, and you can probably hear from my voice this week that I'm not in the best nick. I'm a bit
under the weather.
Yeah, and as a bit of a largy. Yeah. And as part of my completely feeling sorry for myself vibe, every evening this week I've gone home and just watched episodes of The West Wing and chilled out and found it incredibly comforting. And I would do that with a lot of shows. I can't tell you how many times I've watched The Sopranos and Mad Men back. I watched The Simpsons religiously over and over again, and I love the comfort of the familiarity of it, because it will probably take me the rest of my life to catch up with every other show that I haven't watched yet that people have recommended to me. And we've talked about me not really liking recommendations and feeling like I've been put in a box. But
it's also okay not to watch a series that everyone else has watched. You know, you actually don't have to watch.
It's much watched TV. It's important TV, we've covered before. But I like the familiarity of something going back, particularly shows like Mad Men and The Sopranos, which are quite layered, and you pick up various different pieces as you go back and watch it and understand nuances.
Is it not quite daunting heading into, how many series of West Wing are there?
There are 6, but I'm only going to watch the first 4 because I think Aaron Sorkin, who wrote it, he finishes up after season 4. And that's another great thing about rewatches, is you can create your own chronology. Going back, you can delete episodes you didn't like.
You can edit it in the way it should have been edited.
Yeah, it's like, this is how I would have made this. So I'm all for it. I love it. I love hanging out with CJ and Toby and the guys for another few years again.
And like a lot of time when you go back and watch a TV show that you loved 20 years ago, it kind of is, or a film even, it can be dated. Is this dated?
Hugely. It kind of watches as like way too optimistic historical fiction now. Like, it's amazing the sort of scandals that the president was faced with. It's like, this could ruin your presidency. And you're like, 25 years later, oh no, we've gone way down the rabbit hole.
We jumped the shark in real life.
Absolutely. Yeah. So it kind of, you're like, oh, I wish we were as optimistic about our politicians.
I kind of get it, the familiarity thing. Like, there's things that I watch, and they are comfort things, like Modern Family. I watch them over and over again because I just actually love them. And I love Glory. But I love Phil. I love all of them. Claire, all of them. And I get something, and I don't understand, and I sometimes do say something, why are you watching this? You've seen this before and you actually know what's going to happen.
But there is like a psychology behind it as well.
But all the things I haven't seen, you know what I mean? I'm not experiencing new things. I'm just rehashing old things.
There's a comfort in that because you know what's going to happen, so you don't get the anxiety and stress about what potentially could happen. Because I talked about this with my sister, because I'm like, how many times have you watched like The Great Outdoors with John Candy? Like a million times. I'm like, Karen, there are other movies we could watch. But then I read about it. There is the psychology behind, if you are like an anxious person, or even if you, like, not to be too serious, but if you have trauma when you're younger, that familiarity of knowing what's going to happen brings you comfort. So that's why you're drawn to it.
Interesting. I just really like it too. And I do think there's something, it's like going home. Do you know what I mean? It has that kind of vibe.
I'm
revisiting something that gives me a warm fuzzy.
It's funny, like I would watch, Braveheart, I've seen like 45 times or something. And every time it comes on telly, I end up watching it again. Heading into a big like 6 or 7 series, I'm not sure I love Mad Men.
Yeah.
And I get what you're saying about the many layers of it. I'm sure there's loads I'd see if I watched it again, but I'm not sure I could face into it again.
Oh, but it reshapes how you would have watched it the first time, and depending on stages in your life that you're watching it at. Like, same with Catcher in the Rye. I read that every couple of years during my teenage years and got something different every time. And now in Mad Men, I'm totally on Betty's side in the way that I wasn't.
Yeah.
I thought that she was a terrible character and way too emotionally stunted. And then you watch it back and you're like, oh man, you were so right.
She was awesome. Definitely.
You know what? You're right about the prism of time. It changes things. I remember, it's not a TV show, but it was a really famous interview, Michael Parkinson and Meg Ryan. And everyone said at the time, it practically ruined her career. Like she was truculent, yeah. She was difficult, she was all of this kind of stuff. And you know, it was like, oh, Meg Ryan isn't the lovely Meg Ryan we all thought she was. And I thought to myself, God, that's, you know, I watched it back years later. I thought he was awful to her. I thought he was practically abusive to her. He was insulting. He was misogynistic. He was, I hated his interview. And at the time I didn't see that. And I completely inverted what I thought with the hindsight of 20 years. It was weird. It was actually, and then I went back and looked at a few other interviews he did. And it wasn't awful. Just her. It was like Helen Mirren and stuff. And awful. I was like, dreadful stuff. Yeah. But anyway, but at the time, that wasn't how it was framed by the social discourse.
Same with Ellen DeGeneres. You look back on those and you're like, she actually bullied her guests. But we saw it at the time kind of going, it was just the crack. It was just fun. And now it's come out kind of going, actually, that was pretty awful.
Yeah, it's funny. Anyway, it is interesting.
Okay.
Your winner for us, Alison?
Olivia Rodrigo. So I don't know if you followed this over the weekend, but Daisy Field was a festival. Did you see it?
No.
That she curated, and it only was announced it was going to happen in June, but she curated it and it happened last weekend. It was a one-day festival, all female acts and no competition between stages. So it wasn't like Electric Picnic where you're darting from wherever to try and catch everything. But the big thing is that she raised $10 million and then Melinda French Gates matched that $10 million. So it was $20 million that went to loads of different charities for women and girls in America, like Planned Parenthood, Baby to Baby, which is a big charity, Black Mamas Matters Alliance, Indigenous Healthcare, like all of that. So it was all just good. So it was like Chapel Roan joined her on stage. Sarah McLachlan, I don't know if you guys know that name. She's Canadian. Alanis Morissette, also Canadian. And they all joined on stage. And yeah, just like just good.
You felt like it was a very empowering thing, like women for women kind of idea.
And the fact that, like, obviously there's all these talented women that, you know, can draw huge crowds anyway based on their talent. And then the offshoot of it was this amazing amount of money was raised and Melinda matched it. So it was $20 million.
The movement of female artists nowadays is mind-boggling, I think.
They dominate the charts.
In a great way. I don't mean mind-boggling. I mean, in that, I don't think when I was growing up, there was female artists. There was Blondie, there was Madonna, there was. But predominantly...
Susie Quattro.
Yeah.
But predominantly music was dominated by men,
you basically
male artists and male bands, and a lot of male bands might have had a Transvision Vamp or something, might have had a female artist or Blondie or whatever, the Pretenders.
Wendy James.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Transvision Vamp?
Yeah.
But anyway, but it's just a whole new era.
Oh, totally.
And it's men buying into it, it's women buying into it, it's women believing in themselves. It's really, I think it is a very positive thing.
Moved away, I suppose, in a way, like you've got obviously bands like Cat's Eye and that kind of manufactured situation still happening, but the charts are very much dominated by solo artists now. Like you don't have the same creation of bands that you would have then.
Can I... maybe strike a cynical note.
Uh-oh.
And look, I wasn't really aware of it, but when I hear celebrities doing stuff for charity, instinctively, I kind of roll my eyes a little bit.
I understand what you're saying, and I'm always impressed when people do it. Like, say, you know, what Dolly Parton did, with people didn't know until she passed what she did, but I understand what
she
you're saying.
She gave her money away. I think that's hard to knock.
Yeah, of course. I understand. But I think that the benefit of like these charities, like especially say the Indigenous Healthcare organization, like I can't imagine they are high on people's radar when it comes to funding. So just if anything good can come of it and money can be put towards causes that affect women and children.
No, I get that. I suppose my question is how much of it is performative?
Yeah.
And I don't know.
She probably got something from it, for sure.
Yeah,
I don't know.
That's fine, I suppose, as well.
It's more how much, for me, it's how much of it is effective. Like, you can raise $20 million, and that's great, and if it funds certain charities, but actually knowing where that $20 million goes and what that works towards. There was a great book I read a couple of years ago by an economist called, it was about effective altruism, and he started out by listing off, I can't remember the water pump, but it was like a roundabout that you would bring to villages in Africa. And what it did was it would act basically as a water pump, but for kids pushing it round so that they could play. I think it was called the Play Pump, and loads of different celebrities, I think the Obamas got on board. And basically they proved afterwards that this thing was totally ineffective because the kids would get way too tired to pump this. So it would end up being mothers or adults pushing this round and exerting the same amount of energy they would have to walk 10 miles down the road to get water. But it seemed like a really good catch-all idea. So whenever I see those stories, I think they're great that you're raising awareness for a specific cause or issue and different charities, as you say, that I wouldn't have heard of before. But money only goes so far if it's not used in the right way. Yeah. And that would make me a bit skeptical.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. I remember there was lots of talk about where the money went after things like Live Aid. Did it actually get to the end point where people wanted it to get to? But I guess, I don't know, I don't have obviously some solution or answer or anything here, but I wonder at the same time, is it still a good thing that people are trying things and trying to move some way in the right direction towards things?
I read an interesting piece on this as well, and I suppose this is another knock-on effect of it. It was by a female columnist in The Guardian, and the headline is Olivia Rodrigo is standing up for the vulnerable. I wish Taylor Swift would do the same.
See, that's the other thing, and I think we have talked about this before on the show about, like, do the celebrities owe us, you know, all of these things.
One of the reasons we all loved Dolly Parton was she refused to speak on any issues in general. I mean, she was very pro-LGBT and things like that, but when she was asked about politics, when she was asked about contentious, she goes, I'm an entertainer. Yeah. I don't do that. And we loved her because on the one hand, we demand that Taylor Swift comments on divisive things or on social issues or whatever. But then half the people are going to love her for it and half the people are going to hate her. And why should she insert herself?
But yeah, that's it. She is an entertainer. And then, like, I mean, when she did her recent Eras tour, well, 2 years ago, she donated to food banks everywhere she went. And also the other dialogue is pitting women against each other once again. And there's that long running narrative that Olivia and Taylor, which I'm sure you're totally au fait with.
Totally.
He lives for it, to be honest, Alison.
He's all about
it. Waiting for the next installment.
Anyway.
Okay. All right. We got to take a quick break there to get the news headlines. Here's Eamon.
And you're very welcome back to Winners and Sinners. Cameron and Alison are still with us. Alison, give us your sinner of the week.
Well, we just kind of touched on it a little bit with Dolly, but 2026 is my sinner. We have lost a serious amount of impressive people this year. Some of my favourites, Catherine O'Hara, and I have to admit, when that happened in January, I actually did cry, and then I felt really stupid about crying because I didn't actually know her. But we grew up with her on SCTV. But Dolly, Tim Curry, back to back, basically. That's an awful way of saying it. Brenda Fricker, Sam Neill, Bonnie Tyler. It's just been awful for people who are universally loved and I think revered. And what I was thinking about in particular when Dolly passed is that you've got people that are doing good, like Gloria Steinem, obviously. You know, she was in her 90s, we would expect, but they are doing good. So then who replaces this good if it's not being done? So you think about the Imagination Library that Dolly did, the money, how she spent the money, the royalties. Well, I will always love you. Like all the good things she did, you're like, oh my God, we want someone to fill that now.
I think they do it. I mean, you mentioned before the news there, Olivia Rodriguez. Mm. I think human nature is such that there will always be people willing to do good. Mm-hmm. There'll always be people willing to do bad. But both of those things are a kind of a constant truism, I think.
Yeah.
I wonder, is it a function of age?
Yes.
That as you get older, the people that you grew up looking up to or hearing about or watching or listening to or whatever it was, that one by one they're peeling off. What was it, 2006 was the year of Prince and George Michael and Bowie. And what
2016.
2016. Yeah. What did I say?
2006.
Sorry, I meant 2016. Yeah. Forgive me. But they dropped like flies. And I remember being horrified because they were all musicians that I had genuinely cared about.
There's also
obviously not knowing from Adam.
There's also a reality that the age of celebrity is quite short. It doesn't go back that far. So once you get to a certain year, I don't know if the year was 2016 or whatever, you are going to have more celebrities dying because they're getting to that age.
Yeah, and everyone I mentioned on the list is like, and we don't think of like late 70s as old anymore, like, or 80 even anymore, but like they are, like Gloria was 92, I believe. Like, so it is exactly as you said, Kira. These are people that I looked up to, and then you reflect on your own life and getting older and all of that. So, yeah, this year's been bad.
We are only on this planet for a very short period of time, and I often think to myself, and I think to it myself deliberately for a kind of perspective, that in 100 years' time, pretty much none of us will be here. No one who's currently on the planet today will be here, more or less. Mm-hmm. We will be replaced by an entirely crop of humans, because we are like crops.
People won't remember us.
We will be harvested by the Grim Reaper and we will all be gone. And no one, exactly, we won't, yeah. we'll cease to have mattered. And those people will have lives that are important to them in the future. They will have trials and tribulations and conflicts and loves and all of that. And that is what it is to be human.
Do we... Do we go overboard about celebrity debt? So that's the other question.
Another note of cynicism.
Well, I mean, you go back to the Diana thing. You know, I mean, that was.
I think you're going to be affected by, like, I was affected by Catherine O'Hara really badly, and Dolly, and in the sense when I say really badly, but I was actually embarrassed. As I said, I was like, oh my god, when I read it, I was at the dinner table and it came up on Instagram, and I just like felt that, you know, that sting, and I was like to my husband, he's like, what the hell? I was like, Catherine O'Hara's died. I feel really stupid. I'm about to cry. Like, so you do feel that way, but there are other people that have passed. Like Tim Curry, I thought was an amazing person for what he did and what he stood for, his advocacy, but I didn't tear up. Like it was very sad. Yeah. So it just depends on you. Like, Lord help me. When the boss, let's just say that. Or Harrison Ford.
I'm with you. I'm so with you.
Forget it. I'll
have to take
a week off.
I was about to say, I'll have to take time off.
I like what, when a big celebrity death occurs, like Dolly Parton or Gloria Steinem, especially this week, that it's very hard to analyze someone's legacy or their whole life while they're still on this earth, because obviously they're still producing or they are still living. Whereas it feels like their life is now self-contained and we can pick it apart and look at it.
That doesn't really happen, though. What happens is we tend to canonize the person.
In a way, but
it's only years later. That's my issue. Diana Spencer was the obvious example. I mean, she was utterly canonized. I'm sure she was a very nice, decent person. She did a lot of good, but I mean, it was ludicrous afterwards, the aftermath.
I think it was circumstance and age with her, wasn't it? And the fact that...
I was terribly sad. I felt sad for her at the time.
Yeah.
I felt sad for her kids, as I would for anyone. But I mean, I remember hearing somebody on the radio say, it's like a death in the family. And my mother was really perilously ill at the time. And I remember roaring at the radio, sorry, it is not like a death in the family. Yeah. It just isn't.
This is a psychological... it's a bit like what you were saying about the reason you go back and watch things over. There's an actual parasocial relationships where you believe that you have a connection to somebody because they are so ubiquitous maybe in your life and you feel a connection. They don't know you from Adam, but
I get that. I get that idea of it.
You know them, so they matter to you.
A musician who you grew up with. I get there's an affection there. I totally get that. But
it's not like your own family, quite. But it is a weird one-sided relationship that exists psychologically for people.
Yeah. I don't know. Okay. Cameron, what is your, who or what is your sinner of the week?
I think retirement in sport is the sinner this week because, I mean, tomorrow night we are going to see the end of the career of possibly the greatest Irish sports person of all time in Katie Taylor. And what a way to go out at Croke Park, sold out, huge Irish contingent on the undercard before she takes on Flora Peely. And it's a great way to bow out. But there were two other stories this week that caught my eye and made me think very deeply about sporting retirement. Lionel Messi retiring from international football finally, and finding it very hard to go on after the death of his father Jorge, who was in his corner for so long and for so much of his career. But someone who hasn't retired but looks like they're going to very, very soon, and it seems like their debt has finally come due, it's Novak Djokovic. Did you see the video of him playing the first round match at the US Open? And I think it's the first time in 20 years he's lost a first round match at a Grand Slam and looked like he was about to collapse. It was so much pressure. This video that ESPN very helpfully put in slow-mo of him getting sick on the court. He was actually crying towards the end of the fifth set. And
age is he now?
39. Okay. And he's still chasing that 25th Grand Slam to become the greatest player of all time. And Novak Djokovic is not my favorite tennis player in the world by any means, but I don't think anyone could watch the video of him watching and feeling time actually just catch up with him in the moment and not feel the pang of sadness for one of the greatest sporting careers of all time. And reflecting on it this week, I was torn between this is so sad and sport ruthlessly moves on without you and spits you out and tells you you're no longer good enough, or cuts your career short because of injury and we see other disciplines where that happens. So on the one hand, I feel terrible sympathy for someone who's forced to give up something that they have pursued for such a young age and gone on and has been their life for so long, while also thinking these guys are multimillionaires, who really cares?
Yeah, I mean, I gotta say that's where I'm leaning.
Yeah,
I don't have huge.
You're in a funny form today, Jingle.
I don't have huge sympathy for Lionel Messi. He's a billionaire,
no,
probably.
That's it.
He's
yeah.
had an amazing career. He's been faded. He's, what is he now, 37, 38 or something?
Yeah.
He's had an extraordinary career. Yeah. And I accept readjustment is going to be difficult. And but, you know, like.
You are right. They're going to have amazing lives after sport. But I know what you mean. And I was thinking about it, like, this happens in the animal kingdom, the top lion in the pack that rules the roost. Sport, I often think, is a kind of a proxy for war or
the
competition.
Alpha. Yeah,
but
yeah.
the alpha in the pride eventually gets torn asunder by the young fella that comes up behind him. Do you know what I mean? And that happens, and that's what happened. That's kind of on a different scale, what's happening there. Eventually, younger, fitter, stronger people come along and play them off the court, off the pitch, whatever it is. But I do feel sort of sorry for that.
Would
letting
do,
go and loss of status, position, ability.
I don't.
Would they do like a psychology? Like that would be part of, I imagine, sports psychology, how to exit your profession.
A lot of players, a lot of people really, a lot of sports people really struggle
with this.
They
talk about
this.
It going from hero to zero, and it is the precipitous fall is incredibly difficult to deal with.
Yeah. And again, Djokovic has had a career much longer than many tennis players and more successful. So your sympathy is limited in the grand scheme of things. But I just found it very shocking that a player who's been at the top of their game for so, so long suddenly just completely crumbles and doesn't know how to deal with it.
Maybe he should have gotten vaccines.
Novak
Djokovic, as they used to call him.
There are lots of sports people who go on to have amazing second careers. Like Gary Lineker. I think Gary Lineker found it really easy to walk away. Now, if he was here, he'd say it wasn't. But I think he found it quite easy to walk. He was ready to move on, do something
different. He had
different.
His ducks in a row.
Now he's had
this
brilliant career outside it. George Foreman. I mean, the Foreman grill.
He
come
made the grills.
But he was still boxing up until three years before that. And the Foreman grill was kind of a last ditch of, like,
but he made
attempts
more money,
to make money.
He made
again.
More money in business than he did ever in boxing.
Yeah, sometimes that works out.
Sue Barker, tennis player, great career. So, like, I think it's about finding something different. You know, and like, it's nice that you can take a few years off, like, to find yourself and all
you've
that.
Got a
most
bit,
of us in the real world don't have that luxury, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe I'm just.
You're both
I'm unsympathetic
right.
about
you're
everything.
Both right, your brother. We're going to have to take a short
break.
We have to. What side of the bed did you get up this way? We have to take a quick break. We'll be back after this. More winners and sinners.
Ignition sequence start.
This is the last bit of the show.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff.
Okay, you're listening to Winners and Simmers. Winners and Sinners, even, not Simmers.
You've been simmering all day.
Yeah,
jeez.
I have. Alison Curtis and Carolyn Hill are still with us. Alison, any other business from you?
Have fun. I was just thinking about it.
Okay.
Like, yeah. And although I think you do, actually. I don't think we have to encourage you.
Yeah. Maybe, you know, just tone it down a little bit.
They're all looking at me in case you don't know who she's talking to.
I don't think we need to explain that to the listener.
So my husband and I were like talking 2 weeks ago, and he's like, "Ah, God, we've fallen into this trap of just giving out." You know that way where you're just like, "Oh, this is so."
It is a real trap as well.
Yeah,
isn't it?
And like, can you kind of egg each other on? You're like,
"I've been
doing
it all day."
But you seem to be, bills, this, that, and then he's just like, "Forget it," and like walked off. He's like, "I gotta go see The Odyssey before it's out of the cinema." And I was like, "My attention span won't hold that."
So off he went. Fun.
Well, I know exactly. And then go to gigs and all this. Like, we've just been kind of, I haven't been saying yes to a lot of things lately because you're like, I've worked this, I'm tired, blah, blah, boring, boring, boring. So we're going to go to a gig tonight,
embrace
even though
this.
I don't normally go out on a Friday.
Good seats for us.
We're going to go to a comedy gig, Judy Love, because I normally have to go to bed at like 9:05 on Friday nights or whatever for Saturday mornings. But I'm like, forget it. I might be tired tomorrow, but that's okay. You can be tired.
Okay.
Just go. And I'm bringing my daughter with me because she hasn't seen us in weeks. So she needs to hang out with us. And a couple of other things came up this week. I'm like, just say yes. Have fun.
Yeah.
Kind of going back to your point, we're here here for a short period of time. Have fun.
We're here for a good time, not a long
time.
Even
if I'm old, still, I know you're not, but we are. Have fun. Just have fun and stop talking to your spouse about not having fun.
I do think saying yes to things is a good thing.
Yeah.
And I think saying yes to things creates its own momentum
in
your life because energy, I don't mean like in kind of a feng shui kind of way, but I think doing things energizes us
physically
and psychologically, and I think it then lends itself to doing other things, and you know what I mean, it's like you change your path, and I think that's a good thing
completely. Like so I've said yes loads.
Interesting, because obviously, you know, you're from North America, from Canada. I think there's a more upbeat attitude to life in
Don't get me started on this.
Well, I mean, I think we love complaining in this country.
Well, I think, but we're better in Ireland at actually kind of going, all right, do you want to go for a pint right now? Yeah, we will, okay. Whereas in Canada, they'll be like, well, I can do it next Tuesday after my book club or something like that. So I do think we're better at being spontaneous, and we're better at being social here, and we're better at being social intergenerational as well. Like, people would not hang out with people that aren't really 3 years either side of them in Canada, basically, as a rule. So I think we're really good at that. And you can talk to anybody and strike up a conversation here. So I think we are better.
That's really interesting. I wouldn't know that. I don't know enough about Canada to compare. But I know certainly I like intergenerational.
Yes.
I was at a family thing about 2 weeks ago, and I had an aunt and uncle there in their 90s. It was like all of us at our generation, but the younger generation were there in their 20s, nearly kind of 30, some of them now. And oh my God, it was so much fun. And I actually love, and I actually like really like hanging out with my own kids. I don't just mean like parenting. I mean like, let's do something and hang out and chat. And I get something out of that big time. I like that a lot.
1,000,000%. Yeah, no, definitely. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Karen, any other business?
Don't worry. I'm coming back to cynicism here, Shane. So you're
poor
in familiar
Shane,
territory
now I feel like
again.
We've gone too far. Yeah, I think we maybe have.
It's fine. Keep it going.
So Naomi Osaka, to go back to the US Open for a bit.
Oh, for God's sake.
She was complaining and speaking in press this week about the proliferation of influencers that are going to the US Open this year and basically having photo shoots during her matches. So it's become such a distraction that I was watching a couple of matches even yesterday, and the umpires have repeatedly had to tell people, could you please be quiet? Please stop with the ring lights. Please stop taking photos because these things have become a thing to be seen at instead of an actual sport. And Osaka basically, in very polite terms, in fairness to her, said, please respect the etiquette, read up on what this sport's about before you come, because it's hugely distracting to us and ruins the spectacle for everyone else. And it just reminded me of just, I hate influencers. I just do. I really think, on the whole, they have been a pox. And I find it so, so annoying, particularly now, because I read this week about micro-influencers. Have you heard about these?
Oh my God, no.
Where they are
they really small influencers?
Really, really small influencers. Yeah. You can't see them, but I can, because I'm looking out for them. But they have small follower counts, and they're seen to be more relatable. So that it's not these huge people with lavish lifestyles and sports cars and everything, that it's like, oh, I can relate to this person going to a comedy gig or going to Daily Mount tonight and watching a goal.
He's
and
looking
filming,
at you, Shane Coleman.
And
you
filming myself celebrating a goal because
I never
that's
take
what
out
people,
my camera. Never.
No, you wouldn't do it anyway.
I can't understand people filming.
Or during
like,
a
watch,
gig.
Watch the game.
It's like presenteeism, isn't it? Like you're there, but you're not there. Because you're actually not with these people in the room or in the match or wherever you are. You're with your online audience. Like, what is that?
But micro-influencing was only a matter of time that's going to happen, because literally everybody is online now.
Absolutely.
Like, everybody has an online life.
Finally, the democratization of influencing. Finally, we've come full circle as a society. But I can't. Tourist attractions are ruined now by it, because everyone's taking huge choreographed shoots of them walking beside the Eiffel Tower and pretending they didn't notice it for a second.
It just and it's sprang like, up on me.
It just frustrates me.
Yeah.
I think that's a very good note to end on. Nothing cynical in this room, let me tell you. But you're totally right. And that's our lot, though, Shane. Thank you to Alison. Thank you to Cameron. And thank you for Winners and Sinners.
Yeah, that's our lot for this week. We'll be back on Monday at 4 p.m. Have a great weekend. Do stay tuned to Off the Ball Tourara. Augustoga Boogie.
Come on, Katie Taylor. Have a great weekend.
The Hard Shoulder with Ciara Kelly and Shane Coleman. With Kia. Weekdays at 4 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.